Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 13, where we're going to find two chapters devoted to the laws of leprosy. This is right in the midst of the section, chapters 11 through 15, which gives various states of cleanness and uncleanness, which have to do with barring somebody from the sanctuary, that is, from the ability to worship God in the congregation. Now remember that being unclean is a symbolic state, not a moral state. To say that somebody was debarred from the congregation and from the sanctuary does not mean that, you know, God abandoned them or that they were considered to be on bad terms with God, but rather the condition they were in was a special condition that served to illustrate spiritual things, and therefore the way that they were treated in this condition would illustrate spiritual things too. And to be unclean meant you could not really be in touch with other people. You couldn't have contact with other people without defiling them. And you couldn't go to the tabernacle. So you were, in a sense, isolated from people and from God. The uncleanness would interrupt your relationships with God and with people symbolically. Not literally, because a leper could still have a good relationship with God, in fact, but the symbolism of going to the tabernacle and worshiping, offering the rituals of worship, and his being kept from that is what symbolically suggests that the condition that leprosy and uncleanness in general symbolizes is sin. It symbolizes sin, and leprosy is a lot like sin in terms of some of its characteristics. And chapter 13 of Leviticus is mostly given to a really detailed, one might say tedious, procedure of the priest as the public health official diagnosing whether certain skin problems should be qualified as leprosy or not. And it's obvious from the description that not everything that would be called leprosy would be the same thing that we would call leprosy, because we have much more specific and exact medical names for lots of different conditions. They didn't back then. To them, leprosy was a skin disease. It would include really awful skin diseases, and deadly skin diseases. It would include Hansen's disease, is what we call leprosy today. But we have a whole lot of other skin diseases that we have other names for that they would have called leprosy too. So we just have to not get hung up on the word leprosy, realizing that it's a broader term, just like the word birds was a broader term than we would use because they included a bat among them. Or fish is a broader term than in the Bible than we would use, because a whale would be included as a fish as the word is being used in the Bible. And again, we have to not be so provincial as to think that all of our modern, the range of meanings of our words when we use these words in modern English, that they had to be used with the exact same meanings back then. The main thing was that the priest had to diagnose whether a particular skin condition was infectious or not. Now that term was not used because ancient people didn't know about infection. They just knew that if the condition was such and such, then the person was unclean. If it was otherwise, it's unclean. They're clean. But we can see that the things that made a person unclean was that they had a spreading skin disease that we would recognize in modern times to be infectious and therefore a very good thing to keep out of touch with other people, at least until it was over. Now, chapter 14 is given over to the rituals that would be followed by a person who had previously been declared to be unclean and a leper, but whose condition had passed. Now, there'd be many skin conditions that could have been diagnosed as leprosy by the terms of chapter 13, which would not be leprosy, but would simply be passing conditions. That could even be, a temporary allergic outbreak from certain environmental conditions or even foods that someone would eat. that they would call it leprosy just because it had the appearance. But when a person had been declared a leper and had been, then the condition had passed and they no longer had it, they had to be officially readmitted into society. They had been officially excluded. They had to therefore be officially readmitted, and they had to come back to the priest and offer certain sacrifices and rituals of reentry into normal society. Now, in chapter 13, verses 1 through 17, gives kind of the basic law, the basic way in which a priest would recognize skin diseases that were unclean and recognize the ones that were not unclean. And it starts out by talking about someone who's got a swelling or a scab or a bright spot on their skin. And this could be or might not be something that has to be regarded as a leprosy. But then after it goes through that in the 17 verses, it gives sort of the same information, much the same information about problems that occur on the skin after a boil has healed in verses 18 through 23. And then in verses 24 through 28, it goes through similar information if there's problems after a person has experienced a burn on their skin. And in verses 29 through 37, it talks about sores on a person's head or in their beard, and how that would be examined and decided whether that was a leprosy or not. It also has a section talking about baldness in verses 40 through 44, that if a man's hair is falling out, he's not leprous, he's just bald, it says. But these different sections of chapter 13 have a lot of overlap, a lot of repetition. I'd like to read the first 17 verses, and we'll see almost the whole procedure as it would apply also to cases where an abnormality exists after a boil has healed or after when there's a burn or something like that, which are the other sections taken separately. It says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when a man has on the skin of his body a swelling, a scab, or a bright spot, and it becomes on the skin of his body like a leprous sore, then he shall be brought to Aaron the priest or to one of his sons, the priests, and the priests shall look at that sore on the skin of the body, and if the hair on the sore has turned white, and the sore appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it is a leprous sore. Then the priest shall look at him and proclaim him unclean." So this is easy. If it looks like this infection, if it looks like the sore is deep, not just on the surface of the skin, I'm not really sure how that would appear. I've never seen leprosy, and I don't know exactly how one would tell if it's just on the skin or if it's deeper than that. But if it appears to be deeper, maybe, I really don't know how. And if the hair that is in the sore has changed color and turned white, that's good enough to call it leprosy, and that's the end of it. You call the man unclean, and he's going to have to go out and live alone. But in verse 4, if the bright spot is white on the skin of his body and does not appear to be deeper than the skin, and its hair has not turned white, then the priest shall isolate the one who has the sore for 7 days. Okay, you've got a sore, but it doesn't have those things that are a dead giveaway that it's leprosy. The hair has not turned white. The sore, you can't really tell if it's deeper than the skin. So there's going to be a quarantine for 7 days. The man's going to be not touching anything just in case he does have leprosy. And that 7 days is intended to find out if this is going to develop into something worse. And the priest shall look at him on the seventh day, and indeed, if the sore appears to be as it was, and the sore has not spread on the skin, then the priest shall isolate him another 7 days. So just because it hasn't gotten worse in 7 days, it doesn't prove anything. Now, if it had gotten worse in 7 days, then he's declared unclean. But if he still hasn't gotten worse, they give it another 7 days, a total of 14 days, to see if anything changes. It says, then the priest shall look at him again on the seventh day, which is, of course, the 14th day, end of the second seven. And indeed, if the sore has darkened, which is a good sign, it's not white anymore, and the sore has not spread on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. It is only a scab, and he shall wash his clothes and be clean. So the guy spent 14 days in isolation because he had an ordinary scab. But at least they discovered that it was that, and so he gets to go home after he washes himself and his clothes. But if the scab should at all spread over the skin, either in the first 7 or the second 7 days of isolation, after he's been seen by the priest for his cleansing, he shall be seen by the priest again. I guess in this case, if the same guy who is declared clean has another outbreak of the same problem after he's been cleansed, he shall go back and see the priest again. And if the priest sees that the scab has indeed spread on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is leprosy. Or it is at least what they're going to call leprosy for the purpose of making him unclean. When the leprous sore is on a person, then he shall be brought to the priest, and the priest shall look at him. And indeed, if the swelling on his skin is white and has turned the hair white, and there is a spot of raw flesh in the swelling, it is an old leprosy on the skin of his body. The priest shall pronounce him unclean and shall not isolate him, for he is unclean. There's no sense in quarantining him. He doesn't have to make further diagnosis if there's already the white hair and raw flesh. Then that's all you need to see to know it's leprosy. Now we have verses 12 and 13, which are strange. Because it says, if the leprosy breaks out all over the skin, and the leprosy covers all the skin of one who has the sore, from his head to his foot, wherever the priest looks, then the priest shall consider. And indeed, if the leprosy has covered all his body, he shall pronounce him clean, who has the sore. It has turned white, he is clean. It has all turned white, he is clean. Now this is strange, because the whiteness is the infected portion of the body, and the white hair that grows out of it is the proof of it being leprosy. And yet it says if they've got it all over their whole body from head to foot, declare them clean. And this has been something that people have really puzzled over, because it seems like it's saying if a person has leprosy completely over his whole body, he's not declared unclean. And some preachers have made it sound like, well, this just means that it's like it's sort of a picture of sin, that if you see yourself as wholly sinful, then you're going to be repentant. If you think you're only a little bit sinful, you won't, and therefore you'll be cleansed by coming to full repentance or whatever. But that's stretching it. And it also makes it questionable why God would return a person covered with leprosy back into society without quarantine. We read in the book of Numbers, chapter 12, that Miriam and Aaron criticized Moses for marrying an Ethiopian woman. And God was on Moses' side in the matter and against Miriam and Aaron for criticizing. And it says in verses 9 and 10 of Numbers 12, so the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was, a leper. Now she was as white as snow. Leprosy turned the skin white. And she was apparently completely white, completely leprous. And we find that Moses interceded for her, and God cured her of the leprosy. But here we have a case in Leviticus 13, verses 12 and 13, of a person who's leprous, white as snow, all over their whole body, and they're declared clean. It just doesn't really make sense. Some people would probably assume that there's a textual problem here. Instead of saying he is clean, it should say he's unclean. However, the word appears twice in verse 13, and it's clean both times rather than unclean. It doesn't seem like a mistake would be made twice in the same verse by a copyist. And so I think what we're to understand here is that when the whiteness is throughout the whole body, assuming there's not rawness of flesh and things like that, it isn't leprosy. It's some other kind of depigmentation. For example, an albino would be white from head to foot, but not leprous. It would be pretty strange for leprosy to completely cover the whole body from head to toe in a uniform way. And therefore, I think what it's saying is if the whole body is that way, it isn't really leprosy. It's some other depigmentation problem. There's a disease called vitiligo, which is a case, and black people actually experience this more than white people, but white people can have it too, where the pigment actually just disappears from their skin and certain blotches and so forth on their body. Sometimes it's a pattern, like it can be the same on both arms or something like that, and other times it's not the same. Some people think that these verses are talking about vitiligo, the skin condition where there's just, it's not really they're not sick, they're not infectious, but their skin just loses pigmentation. And yet, vitiligo doesn't usually cover the whole body. So it's hard to say that that's the condition unless it was a very severe case of it. In any case, I think what he's saying is that leprosy usually isn't so thorough as to turn every part of the body uniformly white. And if a person is uniformly white, I'm thinking that it's a case, like of albinism. Although an albino is usually born that way, and this seems to talk about leprosy breaking out all over the skin. It's possible that, when someone presents himself to the priest doesn't know if the person was born that way or not. And if the person's all white, the priest might be inclined to say, oh, that's leprosy. But if the person was born an albino, that would, of course, not be an unclean condition. These verses have been troublesome, but it seems to me that it's just talking about whiteness and it's not talking about raw flesh and other conditions that are associated with the diagnosis of leprosy. So he's saying not all whiteness of flesh is uncleanness. There may be conditions that other conditions cause white flesh that is not bad. Verse 14 says, when the raw flesh appears on him, he shall be unclean. So that's the distinction. Verses 12 and 13, there's no mention of raw flesh, just whiteness. But when the raw flesh appears, then that's different. Then he's unclean. And the priest shall look at the raw flesh and pronounce him to be unclean, for the raw flesh is unclean. It is leprosy. Or if the raw flesh changes and turns white again, he shall come to the priest. And the priest shall look at him, and indeed, if the sore has turned white, then the priest shall pronounce him clean, who has the sore. He is clean. So it does appear that what's in view here is a depigmentation problem that isn't leprosy. But a person who has white flesh like that could possibly have a season where there's some rawness, a scab or a burn or something that combined with the whiteness makes the priest think it's leprosy. But then if that skin problem goes away and the person's returned to completely white again, then it's to be recognized it isn't leprosy. Now, there's similar instructions in verses 18 through 23 about someone who has a boil that gets healed. If a body develops a boil in the skin and it's healed, and in the place of the boil there comes a white swelling or a bright spot, reddish white, then it shall be shown to the priest. And likewise, it talks about if the hair is white and if there's raw flesh and so forth, then he's unclean. It's a leprous sore, it says in verse 22. In verses 24 through 28, similar instructions when it's a burn. Verse 24 says, if the body receives a burn on its skin by fire, and the raw flesh of the burn becomes a bright spot, reddish, white, or white, then the priest shall look at it. And, of course, if the hair has turned white and the thing appears deeper than the skin, then he calls it leprosy. In verse 29 through 37, it talks about sores on the head and the beard. And essentially, it's the same thing. If the hair is turning white or yellowish, it's leprosy. It refers to yellowish hair there in verse 32. And then verse 38 says, if a man or woman has bright spots on the skin of the body, specifically white bright spots, then the priest shall look, and indeed, if the bright spots on the skin of the body are dull white, it is a white spot that grows on the skin. He is clean. That is, if it's not as white as snow, if it's dull white, it's just a depigmentation problem on the skin, such as I have here from getting old. It's just age spots. Age spots can be dark or they can be light, but it's not leprosy. So you don't have to be afraid of me. Now, verse 40, this part just somehow strikes most people funny, me too. As for the man whose hair has fallen from his head, he's bald, but he's clean. He whose hair has fallen from his forehead, he is bald on the forehead, but he's clean. And if there is on the bald head a bald forehead, or bald forehead, a reddish white sore, it is leprosy breaking out on his bald head or his bald forehead. Then the priest shall look at it, and indeed if the swelling of the sore is reddish white on his bald head or on his bald forehead, it is appearance of leprosy on the skin of the body. He is a leprous man. He is unclean. The priest shall surely pronounce him unclean. His sore is on his head. And this ends the instructions about diagnosing leprosy on a person. There are next going to be laws about leprosy on cloth or on garments, and also on a house at the end of chapter 14. But there's no further description of diagnosing leprosy on a person. But we do have, in verses 45 and 46, a description of what the person is supposed to do once they have been diagnosed as being leprous. It says, "Now the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes shall be torn, his head bare, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, 'Unclean, unclean,'" as with his hand when anyone comes near him, he has to let them know he's unclean. Then he has to cover his mouth. To say it suggests that God is aware of something the Jews would not be aware of, and that is that there may be airborne infectiousness. And so it's like we cover our mouth when we cough, because when we cough, we suggest we're perhaps sick. We don't want to spread it. Again, things like that that are intuitive to us in the modern age would not have been known. The scientific basis would not be known for it back then. And we just see, actually, this is the earliest known law of quarantine anywhere in any society. We don't know of any other ancient society that quarantined people with infectious diseases. And that's because ancient people did not know how infection spread. They didn't know that it spread by contact. And they didn't certainly know about airborne disease. We'll find that if a person gets spat on by an unclean person, that the person who gets spat on is unclean also. And so the idea that infection or something could spread through spit, through breath, through physical contact, these facts all presuppose a knowledge of the nature of disease that we have only had for a couple of hundred years. And therefore, other societies didn't do anything to protect themselves from these things because they didn't know about it. Israel didn't know about it either, but God did. And so these laws show an advanced knowledge on God's part of things that that are hygienic. And by the way, this is true also even when we consider the unclean foods in chapter 11. Because a lot of the foods that were unclean are animals that are really not very healthy to eat. They can be eaten safely if they're cooked thoroughly in many cases. But you know, the Jews wandering in the wilderness not having, you know, the best facilities and so forth were in danger if they ate foods like pork of getting, you know, some of the parasites that are commonly in pork. But people wouldn't know about that. God told them about that. So we have God requiring these people to behave in such a way that we would call a medical quarantine. But no society in ancient times other than Israel had such rules. Verse 46 says, "He shall be unclean all the days he has the sore. He shall be unclean. He is unclean. And he shall dwell alone. His habitation shall be outside the camp." So the person who has leprosy is isolated from his family, from all friends. The only people he was not isolated from were other lepers. So that lepers would sometimes congregate together. We see this in 2 Kings. There were four lepers hanging out outside the city of Samaria, who actually, because they were isolated and because they were doomed and starving because there was a famine, they were not afraid to go to the enemies to see if they could get some food. And when they went to the enemy camp, the Syrian camp, they found the enemy had abandoned the camp and left their food behind. So the lepers became the announcers of good news to the starving people in the city that there was food available. But because these lepers were together, and they went together. They really couldn't associate with other people, but they could associate with each other. So there were leper colonies and caves and so forth that the lepers would live in together. But leprosy, as I said, is a picture of sin. It, in fact, is, in some cases in Scripture, it is a judgment that God brings upon people. We saw a moment ago in Numbers chapter 12 that God struck Miriam with leprosy. But then he healed her because of Moses' prayers for her. Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, was struck with leprosy because of his deception. And there are other cases in Scripture. But we've got Naaman the Syrian who had leprosy, and he came to Elisha. And Elisha told him to baptize himself in the River Jordan seven times, and he'd be clean. And his cleansing there, no doubt, is a picture of salvation of a sinner. Because he had leprosy, and then after he baptized himself in the river, it says his skin became like the skin of a newborn baby. Pink, not white. And healthy, not crusty. And it's like he's born again. And so leprosy serves as a picture and a type of sin. And it spreads like sin does. I mean, it may begin in a way that a person hardly notices, a little small defect, a little small blemish morally in their life, and it can spread and become something that takes over the whole life. Like Hansen's disease, it's not really curable by human means. Although, just in recent times, they have come up with cures for leprosy. But in ancient times, it was incurable. Only God could cure a leper. And that's true of sin, too. Only God can really deliver a person from the sin that's destroying them. One of the things about leprosy I find interesting is that it numbs the senses. And that a person with leprosy, their nerves don't work, so they don't feel pain. They can damage themselves physically without knowing they're damaging themselves. And that being so, of course, they do damage themselves a lot. We take for granted the benefit of feeling pain. Because if we are hitting something in a way that's damaging us, our nerves tell us so, and we stop doing it. If our hand is in a fire in such a way that's going to just burn us up, our nerves tell us so, and we pull our hand out. We're continually doing things to protect ourselves from pain because we feel pain. Lepers don't feel the pain, and therefore they don't protect themselves, and they damage their bodies a great deal. They have self-destructive behaviors because of their lack of sensitivity. And sin desensitizes people, too, to the fact that they're doing harm to themselves. And sin is blinding and desensitizing. And so there's a lot of things about leprosy that are a picture of sin. But the leprosy in the Bible actually extends to objects as well as people. And, for example, the rest of this chapter talks about leprosy in garments, which probably refers to mildew or mold or something like that, really. But they just use the word leprosy for any kind of surface discoloration that might spread, like leprosy in a body. It says in verse 47, also if a garment has leprous plague in it, whether it is woolen garment or a linen garment, whether it is in the warp or the woof — the warp and the woof refer to the different directions of the threads in the weave — whether it's leather or anything made of leather, and if the plague is greenish or reddish in the garment or in the leather, whether it is in the warp of the woof or in anything made of leather, it is a leprous plague and shall be shown to the priest. I remember finding a leprous plague in my carpet in an apartment I was in because my daughters, who had lived with me there for 7 months, had let their dirty laundry just pile up in the middle of the room, and apparently a wet bathing suit or something was near the bottom of that pile. Months later, when we moved and we removed that laundry, there was actually a greenish discoloration in the carpet, which although we cleaned it, it was totally discolored. I lost my cleaning deposit on that apartment because they had to tear that carpet out, just like the Jews would. That'd be a leprosy in the carpet. It was greenish and spreading. And My daughter's never paid me back for that deposit either. I have to remind them about that. The priest shall look at the plague and isolate that which is the plague 7 days. And he shall look at the plague on the seventh day if the plague has spread in the garment, either in the warp or the woof, in the leather or anything made of leather. The plague is an active leprosy. It is unclean. He shall therefore burn that garment in which is the plague, whether in the warp or the woof, in wool or in linen, anything of leather, for it is an active leprosy, it shall be burned with fire. Obviously, it's not leprosy such as we find on a person, but this is simply an indicator of how broadly the word leprosy is used in the Bible to speak of just about almost anything that looks spreading. That's not normal. But if the priest looks and indeed the plague has not spread in the garment, either in the warp or the woof, or in anything made of leather, then the priest shall command that they wash the thing in which the plague is, and he shall isolate it another 7 days, and the priest shall look at the plague after it has been washed. And indeed, if the plague has not changed its color, though the plague has not spread, it is unclean. That is, if it doesn't get any better, but it doesn't, even though it hasn't spread, it's still bad. And you shall burn it in fire. It continues eating away, whether the damage is outside or inside. That is, it may be eating away without it being in a visible way, eating away from the garment. It's not spreading, but it's still eating the garment. If the priest looks and indeed the plague has faded after washing it, then he shall tear out of the garment that part that is affected, whether out of the warp or out of the woof, or out of the leather. But if it appears again in the garment, either in the warp or in the woof, then, or in anything made of leather, it is spreading plague. And you shall burn with fire that in which is the plague. And if you wash the garment, either warp or woof, or whatever is made of leather, if the plague has disappeared from it, then it shall be washed a second time and shall be clean. It'll have a hole in it where you remove the affected portion, but you at least will still have most of the garment. And in a day where garments were very expensive and people didn't have any extras, it was certainly better to have one with a hole in it than none at all. This is the law of the leprous plague in a garment of wool or linen, either in the warp or the woof, or in anything made of leather, to pronounce it clean or to pronounce it unclean. All right, now, it says in chapter 14, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, this shall be the law of the leper for the day of his cleansing. He shall be brought to the priest, and the priest shall go out of the camp, and the priest shall look, and indeed, if the leprosy is healed in the leper, then the priest shall command to take for him who is to be cleansed two living and clean birds, cedar wood, scarlet, and hyssop. So here's a case where the man had been declared unclean, but his condition has changed. Either what he had wasn't leprosy, and it was something that just took care of itself over time, or else, if it was real leprosy, it would be a miracle, presumably, that God had healed him. This happened to Miriam. God healed her. God healed Naaman the Syrian of leprosy. And Jesus healed some lepers too. And so there were those rare occasions when a person with leprosy was miraculously healed. But probably in most of the cases, this procedure has to do with conditions that wouldn't really technically be real leprosy, but something else that had been diagnosed as such. Now, the procedure for readmitting the leper back into society once he's cleansed involves two birds, essentially. And then there's some other paraphernalia, some cedar wood, scarlet, and hyssop. Hyssop is the same thing they use to apply the blood to the doorposts at the Passover and to the lintels. It's a shrub that has kind of, the branch, the shrubby on the end can be used sort of like a brush, like a paintbrush, and that's kind of how they used it. It says, the priest shall command that one of the birds be killed in an earthen vessel over running water. As for the living bird, he shall take it, the cedar wood and the scarlet and the hyssop, and dip them and the living bird in the blood of the bird that was killed over running water. Now, I'm not sure what the running water signifies. but it must signify something. Washing away the uncleanness, probably. But the bird that is killed, its blood is collected in some kind of a vessel. And then the living bird is dipped in the blood of the dead bird, along with these other things, scarlet, hyssop, and some cedar wood. Now, the purpose of these and their symbolism is really never described, never explained, and I don't really know what the answer would be as to what they represent. And he shall sprinkle it 7 times on him who is to be cleansed, as the blood of the dead bird will be sprinkled on the man, using the hyssop in all likelihood, from the leprosy, and shall pronounce him clean, and shall let the living bird loose in the open field. Now, the bird that has been dipped in blood is set free, and that seems to have some rather identifiable symbolism, in that the bird that is set free is like the leper who's set free from his plague and set free to associate freely with others as he had before. The bird that was captured was taken away from its family into captivity, but it was released after it was dipped in blood. And so the leper is cleansed, as it were, by blood, as a sinner is cleansed by the blood of Jesus, and then he's free. He's free to associate and with God and with man, again, like this bird who's set free from his captivity. He who has been cleansed shall wash his clothes, shave off all his hair, and wash himself in water, that he may be clean. After that, he shall come into the camp, and he shall stay outside his tent 7 days. Now, I don't know if he just would sit outside all night in front of his tent for 7 days, wrapped in a blanket or something. I don't know how he'd stay warm at night, but he couldn't go into his tent for 7 days. But on the 7th day, he shall shave all the hair off his head and his beard and his eyebrows. All his hair that he shall shave off, he shall wash his clothes and wash his body in water, and he shall be clean. Apparently, he would do this twice in a 7-day period. At the time of his cleansing, he would shave his head, wash himself, stay outside his tent for 7 days, then shave his head and wash himself again, and then it's all done. Then he's clean. And on the 8th day, he shall take 2 male lambs without blemish, 1 ewe lamb of the 1st year without blemish, 0.3 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering, and 1 log of oil. Most of these measurements are not known to us. An ephah is about sort of similar to a bushel. So 0.3 of an ephah would be about 1/3 of a bushel. A log of oil would be almost 1 pint of oil. And for those who only know metric, I can't help you. But there are 3 animals, 2 male lambs and a ewe lamb. Now, what's strange is that these are to be a trespass, a sin, and a burnt offering. And as near as I can tell from reading it, the female is to be a burnt offering. And yet the burnt offerings are supposed to be males. A peace offering could be male or female, but the burnt offering was supposed to be male under the law. For some reason, in this case, a female lamb is used for this burnt offering, and male lambs for the trespass and sin offerings. And we have the procedure given. The priest who makes him clean shall present the man who is to be made clean and those things before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And the priest shall take 1 male lamb and offer it as a trespass offering, and the log of oil, and wave them as a wave offering before the Lord. Then he shall kill the lamb in the place where he kills the sin offering and the burnt offering, in a holy place, for as the sin offering is the priest's, so is the trespass offering. It is most holy. The priest shall take some of the blood of the trespass offering, and the priest shall put it on the tip of the right ear of him who is to be cleansed, on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his foot, his right foot. And the priest shall take some of the log of oil and pour it into the palm of his own left hand. Then the priest shall dip his right finger in the oil that's in his left hand, and he shall sprinkle some of the oil with his finger 7 times before the Lord. And of the rest of the oil in his hand, the priest shall put some on the tip of the right ear of him who is to be cleansed, and on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot. on the blood of the trespass offering. That is, the blood of the trespass offering has already been put in those three places, the man's ear, the man's thumb, and the man's big toe. Now oil is added over the where the blood already is, on the blood. Obviously, as we said earlier, when a similar procedure, a little different, was practiced on the priests, this represents cleansing and anointing of the ear and the hand and the foot, which one would assume represents what one hears or thinks, what one does with his hands, the way one walks. The foot represents one's walk. So these are all aspects of a person's life that are to be cleansed once they are done with the leprosy of sin in their life, once they've been redeemed and set free. They their thinking or hearing, their actions and their walk are all to be cleansed and anointed. Cleansed by the blood of Jesus, anointed by the Holy Spirit. It says in verse 18, the rest of the oil that is in the priest's hand he shall put on the head of him who is to be cleansed, so the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord. Then the priest shall offer the sin offering and make atonement for him who is to be cleansed. That would apparently be the other male lamb. Afterward, he shall kill the burnt offering, which, although it doesn't say so, appears to be the female lamb. And the priest shall offer the burnt offering and the grain offering on the altar. So the priest shall make atonement for him, and he shall be clean. Now, the same instructions are given in verses 21 through 32, but more like hardship cases where someone is too poor to do that procedure. It's really the same procedure. But instead of having three lambs, one lamb and two birds are used. So we don't need to go through this because all the same maneuvering of the blood and the oil and all of that, it's all the same in verses 21 through 32. It's just that in the case of someone who's too poor to bring three lambs, they can bring instead one lamb and two birds, so it's a cheaper solution. And one might expect a leper to not have much money, since if he's been isolated for very long, he can't work, he can't generate money, although it's possible he could come from a rich family that could make a donation to help out here. But if he was very poor, which would probably be the case with most lepers, he could do this cheaper, this less expensive ritual. And then the last part of this chapter deals with houses that are said to have leprosy. Now, this is rather interesting, and I believe it's rather symbolic of something specific. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when you have come into the land of Canaan, which I give you as a possession, and I put the leprous plague in a house in the land of your possession, and he who owns the house comes and tells the priest, saying, it seems to me that there is some plague in our house, then the priest shall command that they empty the house before the priest goes into it. So he's going to look at the plague so that all that is in the house may not be made unclean. And afterward, the priest shall go in and look at the house. So they take all the furniture out of the house, because if the priest goes in and declares the house unclean, then everything's unclean and probably will have to be destroyed. So they get the stuff out first before a proclamation of uncleanness comes, so that if the house ends up being unclean, at least the furniture can be spared or whatever else they had in there. It says, and he shall look at the plague, and indeed, if the plague is on the walls of the house within grain streaks, greenish or reddish, which appear to be deep in the wall, then the priest shall go out of the house to the door of the house and shut up the house 7 days. And the priest shall come again on the seventh day and look, and indeed, if the plague has spread on the walls of the house, then the priest shall command that they take away the stones in which the plague is, and they shall cast them into an unclean place outside the city. And he shall cause the house to be scraped inside all around, and the dust that they scrape off they shall pour out into an unclean place outside the city. Then they shall take other stones and put them in place of those stones, and he shall take other mortar and plaster the house. So this is what they hoped would cure the house. If it's got some kind of mold or mildew or something like that that's spreading, if it spreads in the 7 days between the first time and the second time that the priest looks at it, They've got to remove it. And all the stones of the wall that are affected have to be taken out of the wall. If they are bearing stones, of course it may take the whole wall out, but the point is they have to get rid of all the stones that have been affected. Those stones are carried away to some unclean place where unclean things are deposited. And then they have to, whatever's left of the house, they have to scrape it all down. So every bit of the wall inside that might have some of that infection is like sanded down. And then they take the dust from that and haul that off to an unclean place. And then they replace the stones with clean stones. And they hope, after they've plastered that and everything, that that will be the solution and that the plague won't return. However, it might return. In verse 43, and if the plague comes back and breaks out in the house after he has taken away the stones, after he has scraped the house and after he's plastered, then the priest shall come and look, and indeed, if the plague has spread in the house, it is an active leprosy in the house. It is unclean. And he shall break down the house, its stones, its timber, all its plaster of the house, and he shall carry them outside the city to an unclean place. Moreover, he who goes into the house at all, while it is shut up, shall be unclean until evening. And he who lies down in the house shall wash his clothes, and he who eats in the house shall wash his clothes. But if the priest comes in and looks at it, and indeed the plague has not spread in the house after the house is plastered, then that priest shall pronounce the house clean because the plague is healed. And he shall take to cleanse the house two birds, cedar wood, scarlet, and hyssop, the same as cleansing a leprous man, declaring it clean. He shall kill one of the birds in an earthen vessel over running water. He shall take the cedar wood, the hyssop, the scarlet, and the living bird, dip them in the blood of the slain bird, in the running water, and sprinkle the house seven times. In the case of a man, he sprinkled the man seven times with the blood. And he shall cleanse the house with the blood of the bird and the running water and the living bird with the cedar wood, the hyssop, and the scarlet. Then he shall let the living bird loose outside the city in the open field and make atonement for the house, and it shall be clean. Now this is the law of any leprous sore and scald, for the leprosy of a garment or a house, for a swelling and a scab, a bright spot, to teach when it is unclean and when it is clean. This is the law of leprosy. Now I just say about the house, the leprous house. I believe that this may have symbolic value, just as a leprous man did. It's possible that a house that gets leprosy like this represents the house of Israel or the nation of Israel. Because the people of Israel were essentially one family from one man, they were called a house, the house of Israel or the household. The word house had double meaning in the Hebrew. It could refer to a building that a person lived in, or it could refer to one's household would be their house. And Israel is often called the house of Israel, and the plague could be in a house. The whole of Israel could be infected with sin and idolatry and apostasy, and often was. And there would be steps taken to remedy it, see if the house could be saved. Remove the affected portion. Dispose of the sinners. Dispose of the ones who were carrying the infection. And hopefully the house could be saved. But if the infection came back, and it couldn't be healed by removing just the affected stones, the whole house had to be demolished. Had to be torn down, its stones, its timbers, and taken outside the city and disposed of permanently. The house could not be spared. And it's possible that this is a picture of how God would deal with Israel when the plague of idolatry or sin came to them. Like when they went into captivity in Babylon, that could be seen as the attempted remedy of the first sort. But if the plague returned afterward, then the house would have to be destroyed completely. And the plague did return, as Jesus made clear in his day, that the house of Israel was pretty much apostate again. And it had to be destroyed completely, and it was. And so I think that this law of the leper's house might point in that direction. Also, of course, it would have clear hygienic ramifications. We know that mildew and mold in a house can be very unhealthy to the inhabitants. And therefore, again, God knew things that people didn't know back then. But all these laws of clean and unclean do have some hygienic value. although that is never brought out. That is, the law doesn't mention any of the hygienic considerations. It's all the ritual symbolism that's important here. But we can see the wisdom of God in it just knowing more now about how disease spreads. Chapter 15 is the last of these chapters about clean and unclean things. This is about bodily discharges. Essentially, it talks about discharges from a man and from a woman. These discharges are of different sort, of course, because the man's discharge is usually considered to be that of semen, and a woman's that of blood. Of course, if a man is bleeding from his genitals or his anal cavity or whatever, that's going to be the same problem as with a woman. Any bleeding that's unnatural and abnormal is going to make him unclean. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean. And this shall be the uncleanness in regard to his discharge, whether his body runs with his discharge or his body is stopped up by his discharge, it is uncleanness." I don't really know what that looks like. I won't even try to think too much about it. "Every bed is unclean on which he who is the discharged lies, and everything on which he sits shall be unclean. Whoever touches his bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean till evening. He who sits on a thing," verse 6, or "he who touches the body of him," in verse 7, or in verse 8, "if he who has the discharge spits on somebody," anything like that. Whether you sit on something, he sat on, touch him, if he spits on you, you're unclean. You have to, until evening. You have to change, wash your clothes and bathe, and then you're unclean till evening. If he sits on a saddle, the saddle is unclean. "Whoever touches anything," verse 10, "that was under him shall be unclean till evening. He who carries any of these things shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean till evening." The extreme infectiousness of the ritualness of uncleanness is very obvious here. If a person is unclean, they're unclean. If someone touches them, they're unclean. If someone touches something that they touch, they're unclean. And this, no doubt, is to convey the idea that sin, which is represented symbolically by uncleanness, is something that defiles by contact. If you are, like it says in Proverbs, "Go from the presence of an angry man, lest you learn his ways and be like him." God said to Israel, you have to wipe out the Canaanites or else you'll learn their ways and you'll be defiled by them. Contact with sinners, at least under the Old Covenant, was something that defiled people. Now, of course, we saw that Jesus, he would touch a leper or he would touch a woman with an issue of blood. He would touch somebody that was unclean and they would become clean instead of him becoming unclean. And so the New Testament has a new principle. It does not require that we abstain from all contact with sinners, but rather that we go to them and we seek to infect them with the cleanness of the new covenant of the gospel. But in the Old Covenant, they didn't have that dynamic. They didn't have the Holy Spirit. They didn't have the power of the new covenant to transform the wicked that were around them as we do through the gospel. We can transform societies by our involvement in society, but they had to separate themselves from it because sin, when you have only natural means to resist rather than supernatural means to resist, will always defile by contact. Verse 11 says, "And whomever he who has the discharge touches and has not rinsed his hands in water, he shall wash his clothes," etc. Now, verse 12, "The vessel of earth that he who has the discharge touches shall be broken, and every vessel of wood shall be rinsed with water." Wood is not as porous as earthenware. And therefore, wood could be cleaned adequately, but porous vessels had to be broken. Verse 14, "On the eighth day he shall take for himself two turtle doves." Actually, I better go earlier. Verse 13, "When he who has a discharge is cleansed of his discharge," that is whenever it stops happening, when it's over, "then he shall count for himself 7 days for his cleansing, wash his clothes, bathe in his body in running water, then he shall be clean. On the eighth day, he shall take for himself two turtle doves and two young pigeons, come before the Lord to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and give them to the priest. Then the priest shall offer them. The one is a sin offering, the other is a burnt offering, so the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord because of his discharge. If any man has an emission of semen, then he shall wash all his body in water and be unclean until evening. Any garment and any leather on which there is semen, it shall be washed with water unless it's being held in evidence against the president. And it'll be unclean until evening. Also, when a woman lies with a man and there is an emission of semen, they both shall bathe in water and be unclean till evening. That doesn't mean if she's having sex with him, but if she's just sleeping next to him and he has a presumably a nocturnal emission, a wet dream, then she and he are both unclean, even if it didn't get on her. Just because she was sleeping in the same bed with him, she has to wash herself too. Now it turns to a woman. If a woman has a discharge and the discharge from her body is blood, she shall be set apart 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. This 7 days presumably assumes that this is her regular period, which could be expected to last hopefully no more than 7 days, and then she could be expected to be clean after that. Although it does go into continuing issues of blood that are more than just the period. Everything that she lies on during her impurity shall be unclean. Also, everything she sits on will be unclean. Whoever touches her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. And whoever touches anything that she sat on shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening. If anything is on her bed or anything on which she sits, then he touches it, he shall be unclean until evening. And if a man lies with her at all, in other words, has sex with her, so that her impurity is on him, he shall be unclean 7 days, and every bed on which he lies shall be unclean. So he's unclean, and he's now one who defiles even what he touches. If a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, and of course this is beyond the 7 days, presumably this is, as it says, other than the time of her customary impurity. So verses 19 through 24, we're assuming this is her customary impurity, her monthly cycle. But if it's more days other than her customary impurity, or if it runs beyond her usual time of impurity, all the days of her unclean discharge shall be as the days of her customary impurity. She shall be unclean for the whole length of time that she's bleeding, in other words. Every bed on which she lies, all the days of her discharge shall be to her as the bed of impurity, and so forth. Everything touches her, all of that. Verse 28, but if she is cleansed of her discharge, which means it stops flowing, then she shall count for herself 7 days, and after that she shall be clean. On the eighth day she shall take for herself 2 turtle doves, 2 young pigeons, just like the guy did in his case, and bring them to the priest to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the priest shall offer the one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering. The priest shall make atonement for her before the Lord for the discharge of her uncleanness. Thus you shall separate the children of Israel from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness when they defile my tabernacle that is among them. Now, when it says lest they die in their uncleanness, it doesn't mean that if you become unclean that God's going to judge you and kill you. But rather, if you become unclean, you can't go to the tabernacle. And if you aren't cleansed from your uncleanness and you do go to the tabernacle, he's suggesting that could be fatal, defiling the tabernacle. This is the law for one who has a discharge, for him who emits semen and is unclean thereby, and for who is indisposed because of her customary impurity, and for one who has a discharge, either man or woman, and for him who lies with her who is unclean. One might think that the same amount of information could have been communicated with less redundance and less repetition, but we see that the conditions that are treated in this section of uncleanness, chapters 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, as I said, they range from things that come into you, like the food you eat, the unclean food, to things that come out of you, like a baby in the case of a woman, or some kind of abnormal emissions from the reproductive organs. Again, the baby, reproductive emissions and so forth, those all speak of something that is not quite right with human reproduction. even a baby that is born normally produces excessive bleeding for a period of time for the woman. So that testifies that things are not all that right because of the fall. Human beings being born, the condition is not as good as it was if they hadn't fallen. It's a damaged process, a damaged race. And therefore, what comes out through reproduction, what inheres in a person like a leper, like innate sinfulness that spreads within the person. These are all ways in which it is possible to see sin as defiling, although the conditions described are not themselves sin. But sin is defiling in the same ways, and therefore these rituals of uncleanness are there to communicate that about sin. And yet, the actual laws of cleanness are not applicable to us in the same way, though no doubt the hygienic basis that God had for behind them is still as valid as ever. And there are Christians who do restrict themselves to eating clean foods and, of course, who abstain from blood and things like that. I mean, that would be not unwise. Not for religious reasons, but just because these rules suggest God's higher understanding of hygiene. And so there are Christians who feel, like Seventh-day Adventists particularly, who feel that they should keep these kinds of things. And who can say that's not wise? But there we reach the end of our treatment of the laws of uncleanness.